Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Dell Technologies. What can a pizza chain teach you about pivoting? Where does Bitcoin's true value lie? And does your inbox need AI? Search for Trailblazers in your favorite podcast app to hear all those stories and more.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Melissa Block, and this is On Point. After the missile strikes on Syria last week, the questions were immediate. Did those strikes really cripple Assad's chemical weapons capability? Should the U.S. and its allies have hit harder? What is our Syria policy? My guests today also raise broader questions about what's to come in the Syrian civil war, about the global implications of that conflict, and how it could spread. This hour on Point, the high stakes in Syria. You can join us on air or online. What did you make of the new airstrikes? Do you see a policy shift from a president who just days ago said we are getting out of Syria? What do you think the U.S. and others need to do to stop the killing? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first from Washington is Nahal Tusi. She is foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. Nahal, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And before we launch into the conversation, let's listen to a bit of an account of what happened in these airstrikes. Here is CBS national security correspondent David Martin on Saturday reporting on the U.S., French, and British cruise missile attack in Syria.
A total of 105 long-range missiles were fired, these from a U.S. Navy ship in the Red Sea. They hit targets which the Pentagon's Lieutenant General Frank McKenzie called the heart of Syria's chemical weapons program.
Nahal Tusi, that's the Pentagon's take, the heart of Syria's chemical weapons program. What do we know about the targets and how vital they are to the current regime?
Well, the targets included a research facility and a storage facility, all said to be a part of Syria's overall chemical weapons program. Now, it's possible that these were truly major centers for Assad, but the idea that, you know, in the long run, he might not be able to manufacture more of these chemical weapons, that's not really realistic. I mean, in the past, he has said that he'd given up all of his declared stockpile during the Obama years, but that turned out not to be the case. Plus, he often uses chlorine gas, which is something that's not covered by international conventions on chemical weapons use. And using chlorine in that poisonous way isn't allowed. But the point is, getting rid of all the chlorine in the country isn't also feasible either. So he could still go ahead and weaponize that.
Yeah. And a lot of questions about whether these actually were sites that were still in use or whether these were old sites and everything had been moved around. This is material that is very easy to shift from place to place, right?
Correct. Well, I mean, it's not that easy, but anyway,
well,
but if
not
the thing is, you know, yeah, the strikes happened roughly a week before, and so the U.S. took such a long time in debating what it was going to do that it's possible that the Syrians did have plenty of time to move enough stuff out that really mattered.
We should also mention that it's still unclear what the nature of the attack in Douma, the suburb of Damascus, was on the Syrian population, and I understand that today chemical weapons inspectors have been denied access to that site. They were supposed to be going in to try to figure out, get samples, figure out exactly what was used in this attack. They haven't had access yet.
Right. The Russians say that they don't have the proper permit. These are people from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. They are international inspectors who specialize in this sort of thing. And so this looks like it's just, you know, another way for Syria and Russia to slow down the investigation. And when it comes to something like chemical weapons, time really does matter in terms of being able to determine what was used and how it was used. In addition, Syria has been airing interviews with doctors who say that they investigated as well and looked at the patients and they didn't see any evidence of chemical use. Now, obviously, the U.S. and others are going to say that that's just fraudulent.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, Syria has been adamant and Russia, too, in saying that this was staged possibly with the
cooperation of Britain and the Syrian rebels, obviously. Lots of questions about that account of what happened. Let's talk about the decision-making behind the U.S. strikes in Syria. This comes just as John Bolton has taken over as President Trump's new national security advisor, replacing General H.R. McMaster, who replaced Michael Flynn before him. John Bolton, known to be very hawkish on foreign policy. What do you see as the fingerprints on this decision?
It's actually really fascinating. Back in 2013, when President Obama was considering a strike, Bolton said that, no, he should avoid it. He should stay out of Syria. Now, more recently, however, Bolton has argued for a quote-unquote ruinous strike on Syria, going after Assad in a way that really severely damages him. But in his first week on the job, it seemed like he got outflanked by the Pentagon chief, Jim Mattis, who wanted a more restrained approach, something that sent a message, but nonetheless didn't lead to such an escalation that would drag the U.S. further into the civil war in Syria, as opposed to the fight against ISIS. Now, you know, if you're Bolton and this is your first week and you have all these stereotypes about you, you know, being such a warmonger, you might think, you know what, let me defer to Mattis for now. But that, of course, raises questions about what happens next time. Because if there is another such attack, then the question is, why didn't the U.S. do enough these previous two strikes? And Mattis is going to have a harder time making the case that the U.S. shouldn't escalate further.
Yeah, it's interesting when you talk about sending a message and what that message is. I mean, we heard when President Trump announced these strikes on Friday, we heard him refer to this as a sustained campaign. When the Pentagon came out, when General Mattis came out later, he called this a one-off. And it's really hard to square those two messages coming from the same administration.
Well, President Trump actually said, we are prepared to sustain this campaign. Mm-hmm. And that is different. I mean, what he basically was indicating was, Assad, if you do this again with chemical weapons, we'll come after you. Every time you do this, we're going to come after you. And the hope over at the Pentagon is that Assad will learn his lesson and not do this again. That's, you know, I don't know if Assad has learned his lesson in the past or Russia, for that matter. But, you know, overall, critics in particular say, look, what it really amounts to is that the U.S. is saying, hey, Bashar Assad, you can kill your people in whatever way you want, just not with chemical weapons.
Yeah. Let's go to a call. We are hearing from David calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. David, what do you have to say?
Hi, Melissa. I'm deeply concerned by the fact that, as your guest pointed out, chlorine's readily available and used by this regime. And if we were serious, we would have bombed the airports.
David, are you there?
Do bombing the next day.
So, yes, ma'am? Yeah, we're having a little bit of connectivity issues with your phone call. You're saying, David, if the United States or its allies wanted to be serious, not just to target the chemical weapon sites, but to take out the runways that the planes use to drop these chemicals, I'm assuming you're saying. Nahal, what about that?
Well, you know, this is kind of goes to the heart of the argument is, did the U.S. do enough? Could it have done more in attacking Assad's facilities that are used for multiple purposes, not simply the use of chemical weapons? And that's the question, you know, that I think people are going to try to figure out in the next few weeks or months. Because, yes, you know, we could have gone after his Air Force as a whole. We could have taken out a large number of his facilities that were used for both chemical weapons and conventional weapons. But the fear on the part of some of the folks in the Trump administration is that would signal an escalation that the U.S. is not prepared for or doesn't really want to get involved in, and that we could have retaliation not only from Syria in some ways, but also from Russia, from Iran. And remember, these countries don't necessarily have to strike back at the U.S. militarily. They could do everything from cyber attacks to take various economic actions against our allies or us somehow that affect us. So this is it's a very complicated war. It's a very multi-phase and multifaceted war. Mm-hmm. And people have the ability to fight back on multiple levels, not simply military.
Right. And we'll be talking quite a bit about those broader geopolitical implications of this conflict as we go forward in the hour. Let me ask you this, Nahal. When you think about how President Trump is approaching the war in Syria, in particular with these strikes and the strikes just about exactly 1 year ago after another chemical weapons attack, how does that square with his messages either as a candidate or before he became a candidate on intervention in Syria?
Right. So, you know, when he was a candidate, it was clear he wanted to get out of as much of the Middle East as he possibly could. At the same time, he was very committed to fighting the Islamic State. Now, in Syria, you have, you know, to put it in very simple terms, two wars going on. One is the fight against the Islamic State, or ISIS. The other one is the Syrian civil war, in which Assad is battling rebel forces and in many ways winning lately. And the Trump administration wants to, you know, just focus on one as opposed to the other. The problem is these two wars are not easily divided from each other. They play off of each other. However, you know, if Assad does super, super well in battling the rebels, many of them want to join ISIS, and that strengthens ISIS's ranks. Assad, in some ways, is a recruiting tool for the Islamic State. So this is the thing. It's very hard to break these two things apart, and the U.S. has been trying to do that, not only under Trump, but also under President Obama.
Yesterday, we heard French President Emmanuel Macron saying that he had convinced President Trump not to pull U.S. troops out of Syria. Let's hear a little bit of that.
President Trump said he would like to withdraw from Syria, but we have convinced him that it's necessary to stay there. Think that, diplomatically speaking, these three strikes, which is not the most important thing, we convinced him through that he has to stay. And we also convinced him that these strikes had to be limited to the chemical weapons capabilities.
And Nahal Tusi, after that, White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders did respond. What did she have to say, and how did she reconcile this notion of whether the U.S. will be staying in Syria?
Well, she basically said that, no, the U.S. does not plan to stay forever in the long term. The U.S. wants to limit its fight to the Islamic State, and that the U.S. Will pull out as quickly as it can based on the conditions. Now, how do you reconcile these two things? Mm-hmm. Well, it all comes down to the conditions, right? I mean, for the U.S., something that is short term might, to the French, be long term. What exactly are the conditions that will allow the U.S. to withdraw? There's plenty of people in the Pentagon who, although they don't want to get mired in the Syrian civil war, they do want to make sure that the U.S. has some forces on the ground to keep Syria stable. So it's a tough one.
Okay, now I'll stay with us. When we come back, we're going to ask what the U.S. and its European allies, what Russia and Iran and Israel are all really fighting about in Syria. You can join the conversation. Is the Syrian people's only hope now that the civil war ends with the dictator Bashar al-Assad victorious and the rebels defeated? If Russians, Iranians, Israelis, Turks, and Americans are all involved, why is that? I'm Melissa Block, and this is On Point.
Hi, I'm Mindy Thomas from NPR's Wow in the World, and this week it's all about Operation Earth. How to be cool to a planet that's getting hot. Check it out with the curious and conscientious kids in your life. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Melissa Block. And as I mentioned, we're going to look now at the big geostrategic struggle over Syria, beyond Syria. You can join the conversation. What do you think the real purpose, the real message of last weekend's airstrikes was? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Nahal Tusi is with me. She is foreign affairs correspondent with Politico. And joining us now from Berlin is John Kornblum. He's served in high-level diplomatic posts in both Republican and Democratic administrations with a focus on Russia and Europe. Ambassador Kornblum, thanks for your time today.
I'm very, very pleased to be here, Melissa.
And also joining us from Penn Valley, Pennsylvania, is Ian Lustick, professor of international relations at the University of Pennsylvania, with a focus on the Middle East. Thanks to you, too, Ian.
Nice to be with you, Melissa.
And Ambassador Kornblum, let me start with you. When you think about the message that these airstrikes sent to Russia in particular, key backer of the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, what is that message?
Well, I think the message is twofold. It's already been said. First, there is, however strong Obama's red line was, there is a sort of a red line on chemical weapons, and the Obama administration has already felt it necessary to respond, and I think all of the countries in the Western world want there to be some kind of response when there are chemical weapons.
The Trump administration, you mean?
I mean the Trump administration. Yeah. That's one of the most important parts. Secondly, however, is that the Europeans have been watching this in a state of between a nightmare and shock for some time. It has caused a great deal of upheaval in their own societies, and the many hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of refugees who have come, for example. And they continue to hope against hope that somehow the United States can put together a strategy which will dampen this down and calm it down. And, of course, neither Obama nor Trump have been able to do this. So they look with considerable fear and worry about what's going on there.
Mm-hmm. And Professor Lustig, significant to you that at least Britain and France joined in these airstrikes? Worth noting that Germany did not.
Well, that's right. I think, in general, the fact that the United States is working with Britain and France does show how the United States gets drawn back to the solidity of its alliances. And the Trump rhetoric can't really be taken as what American foreign policy is. You know, there, many people are saying we don't have a policy in Syria, but they're right insofar as they are saying that President Trump hasn't articulated one. But I think that what we've seen here is a very clear statement of American policy. People may not like it, but it's quite clear. When General Dumford referred to this strike as having achieved long-term damage against the Assad regime's chemical weapons, what's that saying is that there will be an Assad regime for a long time to come. We have given up the idea of regime change as an operational goal. The only thing about the Civil War that was said by Defense Secretary Mattis was that all the parties should go to Geneva and negotiate. Mm-hmm. That's really saying we accept the slow-motion partition of Syria. We are really focused not on sending a message to Assad, but sending a message, along with the British and the French, to Russia. It's Russia that has to control Assad, and in return will allow the Russians to have their sphere of influence in useful Syria, as it's called, in the cities, and probably hope, as President Obama indicated, that they'd get bogged down over the long term there with a client that they'll be more trouble than he's worth.
Here's a comment that came in on our website, Creaker writing, basically, Assad was told he gets to keep his job and can keep killing his people as he chooses. Just don't use chemical weapons. Ambassador Kornblum, is that the message, essentially? Well, is there an acknowledgement that Assad has won? And if so, what would be the incentive for him to come to a diplomatic table?
Well, I'm afraid that's comes pretty close to being the message. The incentive to him, of course, is that much he may still be in power, it's one of the most tenuous and most discomforting, uncomfortable holding of power that ever existed. This useful Syria is really a very small part of the country. But I would go back to the point Professor Lustig made about Russia. So far, this extension of Russian power, be it in Ukraine, be it in Syria, be it in a few other places, has not paid off very well for Putin. And you can read, you just have to listen to the volume of Russian rhetoric to see how much they're hurting and how much they really want somehow to get out. So I think I agree completely with what Professor Lustig said. I think that whether we have a strategy or not, I doubt very much that we have a strategy, but the best strategy would be to keep raising the price for Putin and notice that a lot more sanctions have been set out. Some of these sanctions are hurting quite a lot. And if we keep raising the price for Putin, sooner or later, he's going to have to agree that some workable compromise, and I'm sorry to say probably with Assad, is going to have to be reached.
Let's listen to what the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, had to say on Sunday. She was on Fox News, and she was talking about just this question, about how the missile strikes are part of a larger issue with Russia.
Whether it's been with the fact that we've sanctioned just recently the Russian oligarchs, which made their stock market plummet, whether it's the fact that we gave arms to Ukraine, which makes them realize that their life is about to get harder in that region, whether it's us sending 60 spies home to let them know that we're not going to put up with you using a chemical agent anywhere, or whether it's the sanctions that are continuing to happen, which you'll see again on Monday. The international community is telling Russia that either you make a decision on how you act and when you act, or the rest of us will make a decision in isolating you.
So that's the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, there speaking yesterday. Ambassador Kornblum, is there a countervailing view, though, that Putin is still ascendant and entrenched in power and consolidating that power around the world?
I don't have that view. Mm-hmm. You'll find 100 different views on Putin.
Of course.
I would note, just commenting on Ambassador Haley, that mm-hmm. virtually every one of the steps that she mentioned as a strong sign of Western policy were opposed by President Trump at first.
Mm.
And so it shows the confusion. And I could, we don't have the time, but you could go to the confusion of the role of Turkey, the role of Iran. This is as difficult and as probably insoluble problem that we have. And that's why I don't think that Putin is getting stronger. He's certainly not getting stronger in Ukraine. His economy is certainly not getting stronger. And our sanctions are beginning to have some effect. So my hope is that at a certain point, he will decide that enough is enough. All of this flag waving and shooting darts at the West is going to get him nowhere. His economy is going nowhere in any case. And that maybe, if we're skillful about it, we can bring him to the negotiating table.
That's a big if. Ian Lustig, yes. What do you think about that proposition and about that hope that we hear from Ambassador Kornblum?
Yep. I agree in general, but I think it's interesting that that Putin has been looking at and emphasizing in the Russian media the Syria arena, not these other, because there he thinks he's winning. And in fact, if you listen to Nikki Haley closely, she was chest-pounding about all these other things the United States is doing, not in Syria. Because what we've really done in Syria is say, okay, Russia, it's your game. And you're the one that's going to run Assad. We're not going to really be disciplining Assad. You do it. And larger point, as I think Ambassador Kornblum indicated, is so complicated in Syria. Nahal mentioned two wars, but there are many more than two wars going on in Syria. Aside from the United States and Russia and Assad and the rebels, the Turks and the Kurds are at it. Israel is at it with Iran. The Saudi-supported jihadis are at war with the Al-Qaeda-supported jihadis. The Shia are fighting the Sunnis. We're not even talking about Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Yeah.
So when we talk about the United States, some people say wanting to leave the Middle East. Remember, Israel is a big part of the Middle East. It's a big part of this equation, and we are intimately tied with Israel. So you can't talk cavalierly about leaving the Middle East when we just signed a $38 billion deal of aid package for Israel. We are deeply enmeshed.
All of these things interconnected. Let's take a call from Madeline, calling from De Pere, Wisconsin. Madeline, you're on Point.
Hello. I'd like to say I listened to British Broadcasting overnight, and they had a different take. They said that Theresa May and the French guys said that told Trump that they were gonna bomb it, you know, and it was up to him if he wanted to lead. But they were going to do it whether he wanted to do it or not. And he wants to get out of Syria so he can hand it over to the Russians. It's all a political game.
So that's what you heard on the BBC, that England and France were leading and Trump was following suit. Nahal Tusi, you want to come back into the conversation? Any thoughts on that?
Well, that's entirely possible. I mean, it's one of those things where every country is going to spin it to their own advantage and to their own populations. I do think that for Theresa May, this is a very important issue because of the recent poisonings, allegedly by Russia, of a couple of people, a former Russian spy and his daughter who live in Britain. And I think for her, you know, it's not just about chemical weapons use in Syria, but also elsewhere. And so this was to her a very important thing. And so I wouldn't be surprised. I'm actually quite confident that she was very much pressuring President Trump, and Emmanuel Macron was probably pressuring him as well. And so it would have been very strange for something to happen like this without the U.S. being involved. It would have sent a huge signal and further burnished the notion that Trump is in Putin's pocket.
But if I may just jump in, the British and the French could not have conducted that operation without the United States.
Militarily, would not have been possible.
It wouldn't have been possible.
Yeah.
But they could have conducted some sort of an operation.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
But the real signal, though, has to do with U.S.-Russia relations. And, you know, there's an old saying that great powers make war the way porcupines make love, very carefully. And Syria is the place where American and Russian forces are both active in the same theater. This is the first time this has happened in a long time. And without the expectations and norms of the Cold War, so the United States and Russia are working out what kinds of tactics they can use against each other safely. The United States showed that it could use devastating force against Russian mercenaries and kill them almost at will when they attacked a base where we had some soldiers in February. On the other hand, we're unwilling to kill even one Soviet service, Russian service member. So the Russians are learning and we are learning. And what Nikki Haley was doing, I think, is trying to indicate that the messages being sent apply to a wider global arena. What I think is also the case is we're seeing that just as Congress has taken over governing the country from a president who's incapable of doing it, we see the allies and the Pentagon, as well as people like Nikki Haley, essentially making policy out of a melange of things that come out of President Trump's mouth and that happen. And then they try to make lemonade out of the lemons, and it is effectively American policy.
Let's take another call. This is Tom calling from Detroit, Michigan. Tom, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Melissa.
Hey.
I got a question and a comment. Question is, and to me it's real stupid, they've got rules governing war. And, you know, my point is this. Is an exercise in futility for these bombing raids. And I say this, what did they say? To kill a snake, you cut his head off. Assad is not a very nice person, and he's done this more than once. So why not just go after him instead of putting all of these, you know, citizens who have nothing to do with what he's doing, and they end up, you know, getting caught up and become collateral damage? Just take him out, and hopefully, you know, things will be better than what they are with him there.
Tom, thanks for your call. Obviously, this has been a key question throughout the 7-year conflict and before that as well, of what to do about Assad and how actively to campaign for his removal. Is that even still a question on the table, Ambassador Kornblum?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, of course, emotionally, we all agree completely with the caller. But I think you, one of the participants mentioned earlier, the last thing the United States wants to do is to be the one who has to go in and clean up the entire mess or clean it up even with the Russians together. So Assad has been able, through skill, through nastiness, through killing, to maintain some kind of position and to keep the Russians on his side. And as long as he has the Russians on his side, and as long as he has sort of still got the, shall we say, the networks in the country, nobody is really going to want to get rid of him, because if you do, what do you have left after that? That may sound heartless. It may sound rather cynical. But sometimes stopping a bad thing is worse than maintaining a very horrible thing. And that's the problem we're in right now, between the bad and the horrible.
Yeah, it is hard to imagine worse things in the Syrian civil war. Unfortunately, it's not impossible to imagine them. Uncontrolled escalation between the United States and Russia, or a continuation of the war because more resources are pumped into a doomed effort by the opposition to continue, with displaces hundreds of thousands of more people, kills even more civilians. Those are worse prospects. And I think that the fear of escalation between the United States and Russia that Americans, and certainly Americans in the Pentagon, feel is something we can learn from. We can learn why Israel, for example, has emphasized the dangers of the Iranian nuclear threat. They've exaggerated them. They've talked about them in hysterical terms. Why? Because the Israelis don't want to be limited in their use of force in Lebanon and in Syria in the way that the United States feels it's being limited in its use of force by the fear of escalation with Russia. If the Iranians had nuclear weapons, Israel would feel constrained not to escalate in ways that it otherwise would, because who knows what the Iranians would do. So we are starting to learn what it's like for others being engaged in this war.
Nihal Tusi, very briefly before we go to the break, are you hearing on this question of cut off the head of the snake and remove Assad from power, is that anything that's being talked about in diplomatic circles in Washington at the State Department, in the National Security Council, anywhere that you're, anybody that you're talking to?
No, I've not heard that. And I think it's partly the whole question of the day after question. It reminds me a little bit of the Saddam Hussein situation where the U.S. went in, invaded, took out the strongman, and then, you know, didn't really have a plan for what to do afterward, wasn't entirely committed, and then everything went to hell. So I think, you know, in this with this administration in particular, the idea of taking out Assad without knowing what exactly is going to fill that vacuum immediately afterward or in the months or weeks, they're not necessarily prepared. So I have not heard that.
Yeah, obviously a lot of horribly hard lessons learned from the Iraq scenario. Stay with us. Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent with Politico. Also, Ian Lustig, professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and Ambassador John Kornblum joining us from Berlin. We are looking at what the superpowers and the regional Mideast powers are really fighting over while the Syrian civil war drags on. You can join the conversation. Is it inevitable that the Syrian people are basically a pawn in bigger global battles? Should the U.S. and its allies be engaged in the conflict for moral reasons for the Syrian people? I'm Melissa Block, and this is On Point.
Are you funnier than Fallon? More amusing than Aziz? More clever than Click and Clack? Well, if you've got an idea that'll make people laugh, enter WBUR's Next Great Show contest for a chance to get your show on the air. To find out more, go to WBUR.org/nextgreatshow.
This is On Point. I'm Melissa Block. We're looking at the powerful forces at work in Syria's civil war. The message the U.S. and its allies may really have sent with the airstrikes this weekend. You can join the conversation. What do you make of what our guests are telling us today? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests are former U.S. ambassador to Germany and former deputy ambassador to NATO, John Kornblum. Also, Ian Lustig, professor of international relations at the University of Pennsylvania, and Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent with Politico. And Professor Lustig, let me circle back on something you were talking about the implications for Israel and for Iran. And there was an incident not so long ago, a couple of months ago, that illustrates just what those regional implications can be and how they might spread.
Well, one of the incidents that occurred actually occurred right around the time when the gas attack did, which was that Israel attacked an airbase in Syria and killed a number of Iranians, high-ranking Iranians. And unlike previous attacks, when Israel has done this using Lebanese airspace, Russia denounced it and published videos of the Israeli missiles striking the base and indicated that they had come from Lebanese airspace. This was an Israeli attempt to show that they would not only not allow Iranian arms to go into Lebanon, which is what a lot of the Israeli strikes have been about, but to then say that we are willing to actually strike right at Iran's attempt to establish itself near Israel's borders. In other words, Israel was escalating its mini war with Iran in Syria. And Russia was striking back, saying, we have allowed you Israelis to quietly intercept arms going into Lebanon, but we won't allow you to really hurt the Iranian presence in Iran because we have released these videos and will make it very expensive for you politically, militarily, and possibly militarily if you do it again. This is the way that the multiple wars going on are being fought in an implicit bargaining kind of way. The United States needs to understand, and if we are going to play our own cards correctly in this conflict.
Hmm. Here's a comment that came in from a listener on Twitter. Skipper Joe says, I could definitely see a new war coming up. Nothing raises approval ratings like a war. George W. Bush got his second term that way, and I have a feeling Trump may try the same tactic. Nahal Tusi, what do you make of that?
Oh, that's a very wag the dog scenario. I think, again, who knew that Trump was going to win, right? So anything is possible. And if things do get worse, he might feel compelled to strike again. But a lot of it is going to come down to how, for one thing, the midterm elections, how they go, what Congress does, whether there's enough movement in Congress to get Trump to come to them and seek authorization for such use of military actions. This is it's really hard to predict as to how this is going to factor. especially because Trump himself really does not seem inclined to get very involved in Syria beyond defeating ISIS. I mean, he's the one who just a few days ago said he wants to get the troops out. So his mixed messages are not going to help if it comes to trying to get that bounce.
But then there's very much a question of who has his ear, right? And that gets back to the whole question of John Bolton as his national security advisor now and the different competing interests within his own administration.
Right. I mean, Bolton, again, he's known to be very much hawkish. But again, it was his first week on the job. So he is going to be treading carefully for a while. Now, a lot of people have been saying, look, this was an example of how Jim Mattis has exercised his power and his influence on the president. Right. The defense secretary. But the thing is that Mattis, in many ways, is isolated right now in the cabinet. He's lost other allies who have been fired or otherwise pushed out by Trump. And so if there's another chemical attack, or if there's another major event and Mattis is constantly telling the president to temper his own instincts and not strike back, he may not be long for this administration either.
Let's go to the phones again. We have Dennis calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Dennis, you're on the air.
Hi, Melissa.
Hi.
Hey, it's over three quarters of an hour into the show, and you and your guests and your callers have failed to discuss the most important thing, and that is the rule of law. Obama approached negotiations with the Russians and the Syria while there was a request for the authorization of use of force by Congress, and that's a lawful and legitimate approach. Okay, and what they agreed to, while there was that authorization of force sitting in Congress ready to be approved, well, they didn't use attacks after that. But then as soon as Trump just started throwing bombs at Syria about last year at this time, there have been eight more attacks because Trump did not – he was too weak to approach his own Congress. He's as far as legitimacy is, he's too weak. The clear message is not there. If Trump took it to Congress first and he let Congress make the message, and then if Haley had the strength to say, Congress is behind me and I'm going to bring it to the United Nations, that would be a clear message. Congress needs to bring the clear message, and Trump has to ask Congress for it. And he's not, because he is too weak to approach his own Congress.
Okay, well, let's get some response from one of our guests to that. Ian Lustig, what about Dennis's point there?
Well, you know, if only there were such a clear law that couldn't be interpreted by players to their heart's content, Theresa May probably could not have gotten the support of Parliament had she gone there. I don't think, you know, that Trump could have gotten the support either from the American Congress for anything. And it's no matter how you slice the law, the use of force in these particular ways has become something that the president is allowed to do in the United States. I'm not surprised that we haven't talked about that much on this program. And I'm not surprised it hasn't become a decisive and important criterion, and I don't think it really was for President Obama either. I think it was a tactical decision on his part to, in that circumstance, but not in others, appeal to the law as the reason he had to go to Congress.
And, of course, there are moves among some members of Congress to introduce legislation that would require the president to bring airstrikes like this before Congress. Tim Kaine of Virginia, among others. Nahal?
It's really striking. I mean, first of all, to talk about Congress as if it's a monolithic entity, it's not wise. But I'm going to do so for a second. If Congress wanted to act, then it needs to get its act together. One of the most striking things is that when President Obama was mulling whether or not to strike Syria, Republicans were the ones going, you know, out of their way to insist he has to come to Congress for authorization. This time around, it's Democrats who are doing so for President Trump. So a lot of this is about partisan politics and individual lawmakers' own, you know, political needs. And so that's one of the things about the U.S. system is that that there is no, you know, to say turn to Congress and have Congress come up and do something, that's just not something you can necessarily rely on. Furthermore, I do want to add, there are some scholars who will say that President Trump was within his rights legally to act as he did under, I believe it's the War Powers Act or something. But there are some legal scholars that say that he was fine in terms of his actions when it came to the rule of law.
Let me ask Ambassador Kornblum there in Germany about something, because there has been talk about looking toward a Balkan solution for Syria. In other words, something along the lines of what resolved the brutal conflict in the Balkans. And I believe, if I'm right about this, that you were a special envoy to the Balkans back in the 90s.
That's right.
Is that at all a template of how this could end up, how this could be resolved?
Well, it could if the conditions were there, but the conditions in the Balkans were present only after about 4 years of horrible war.
Yes.
Let's start with that. Secondly, you had all of the major powers, including the Russians, willing to join a group, which I was part of, the contact group, in order to make this happen. Thirdly, by the way, the United States used military force several times with no authorization from Congress in order to soften up the Serbs so that they would negotiate. And fourthly, we were able, really fast, and this is maybe the key point, to mobilize NATO and to send 60,000 troops into Bosnia within about 2 weeks to make sure that the war didn't keep going. As far as I can see off the top of my head now, none of those conditions pertain right now. We're not together with the Russians. We don't have a NATO ready to send in troops. The only bad thing is, of course, that there has been a war going on even longer than the one in Bosnia. But another example is the beginning of the big era of detente, which started us into a positive relationship with the Russians. That came only after we had sort of fought each other to a standstill. And this summer, 50 years ago, the Russians invaded Czechoslovakia. That seemed to be such a zero point in the whole relationship that the West started finding ways of negotiating with the Russians, and the Russians themselves knew that they were isolated, so they started negotiating with us. We had great leadership at that time, Willy Brandt in particular, but in this case, Henry Kissinger was obviously a brilliant negotiator. Maybe that doesn't pertain right now, but in many cases, people first have to become exhausted before they're ready to talk.
Let's go back to the phones and to Nora, who's calling from Hanover, New Hampshire. Nora, you're on Point.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
I'm wondering why are we afraid of a second-rate military like Russia? A couple of weeks ago, we killed 100 mercenary Russians. It didn't even make headlines. Russia didn't exactly retaliate. They're all talking. They're trying to prove their second coming after the breakdown of the Soviet Union. And we're just, General Mattis took such a weak strike. We didn't even take out Assad's Air Force. We didn't even take out the Chemical Weapon Research Center. Apparently, it's a cancer research center or something of that sort. We said never again, and we have to stick to that, and not just the U.S. I'm talking about other world powers as well, because this is not solely our responsibility. But I just can't understand how we can sit and let these humans die for the past 9 years. We're watching it live, and we've become numb to it, and that is very scary, because Syria is not the last place that's going to be hit by chemical weapons if we stay quiet as we've been.
Okay, Nora, thank you for your call. Seven years of war, I believe, in Syria at this point. Ambassador Kornblum, we heard from Nora there thinking about Russia as a second-rate military and also referring to a strike, and maybe we should talk about this. This was a U.S. strike on Russian mercenaries in Syria, not Russian regular army, but Russian missionaries Russian mercenaries who work for a private military contractor. Talk a bit about that.
Well, yes. I mean, you go back. I mean, I can understand. I can identify very clearly with the feelings of the caller. I think all of us have the same feelings. But we had, as many people in the United States government were arguing the same point about Iraq 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
All we had to do was come in with a major military force. The government would collapse. The country would welcome us.
With flowers, yeah.
With flowers, strewing the street with flowers. The problem is, and this goes back all the way to the Vietnam War, which some of us remember, that when Western countries, European or Americans, or also Russians, think of their experience in Afghanistan, when Western countries get into these traditional, tribal, non-Western societies, you find out that the logic that was so brilliant on our planning boards in the Pentagon or wherever simply have no effect. And so you get bogged down in a war. And this is what I think is going to be happening with Russia. That's why I'm a bit more optimistic than other people.
Mm.
But the fact is that all this, most of the people who are in charge now over the past 20 years were brought up with pictures of World War II in their heads. Quick movement, blitzkrieg, tank war, General Patton. All of those things simply don't work in these kind of wars. And so, again, I can identify clearly with the feelings of the caller, but I can also recall how much pain and how much suffering it has brought to our country when we disregarded what has turned out to be a real truth about getting into these societies.
And I'd like to also say,
Professor Lustig, yeah,
it's just not the case that Russia has a second-rate military. We struck with incredible force units armed only with assault rifles, and we killed 200 of them and wounded probably 100.
We're talking about the attack on the Russian mercenaries, right, in Syria, yeah.
But we knew very well, as did the commanders of that unit, tapes of those commanders screaming profanities at the Russian government for not supporting them have been published by the Voice of America. The fact is, we know that the Russians have terrific capabilities that could actually shoot down probably some of our missiles and inflict real casualties on us. We don't want to have that kind of encounter. The stakes in Syria aren't high enough for that, and they're not high enough for the Russians to take those risks either, which is why our attack, small as it was, may well have been an effective way to stop Assad from using chemical weapons again, because the Russians won't let him. Not that that will change the strategic course of the war. As I pointed out, I think we're moving toward a slow-motion partition of the country, in which Turkey will be responsible for parts of the north, the United States will be responsible for Kurdish areas in the east, and the Russians and the Iranians will essentially be responsible for the cities. And Assad's behavior can in that way be moderated, and we can look forward to some kind of a long-term negotiating process that could allow rebuilding and the return of many, if not, but probably not all, of the refugees.
And Nihal Tusi, to that point, is there a diplomatic corps within the State Department, within Washington, the Trump administration, that would be engaged on that level of diplomacy required to work out something like a slow-motion partition that Ian Lustig is talking about?
At the moment, the State Department is not as well staffed as it probably should be.
That would be an understatement, I think, yeah. You're being very diplomatic in your language there.
I've taken some of that up. We don't have an assistant secretary of state yet for the Middle East. There's just so many top positions that are filled. We don't have ambassadors to key countries in that region. There's a lot. I mean, there's lots of, like, you know, worker bees who mm-hmm. are at the lower level who'd want to get involved, but the State Department's not really running the show on this.
And it takes a huge amount of commitment and engagement on that. I want to thank all of you for joining us today. John Kornblum, former U.S. ambassador to Germany. He joined us from Berlin. Ambassador Kornblum, thanks so much for your time.
My great pleasure.
Ian Lustig, professor of international relations at the University of Pennsylvania. Ian, thanks to you too.
And thank you, Melissa.
And Nihal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. She joined us from Washington. Nihal, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, outrage grows over the arrest of two black men at a Philadelphia Starbucks. The CEO apologizes as the video goes viral. I'm Melissa Block, and this is On Point.